The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
On the early morning of June 27, 1995, 27-year-old Jody Huizentrout, a news anchor in Mason City, Iowa, overslept and rushed out the door to head to work, but she never made it. Concerned co-workers called the police, who found Jody's red Mazda Miata in her apartment's parking lot. Evidence at the scene suggested a struggle, leading police to believe that Jody had been abducted while walking to her car. In the days that followed, search teams scoured Mason City and beyond, but no trace of Jody was ever found. It's been more than 29 years since Jody disappeared, and investigators are still searching for answers. Hey everyone, welcome back to Detective Perspective. My name is Derek Levasseur. I'm a licensed private investigator and former police detective. Each week I'll be covering an unsolved case in story format. I'll then give you my perspective on the investigation and provide contact information for the individuals or organizations connected to the case so that if you have any tips, you can contact them directly and maybe you can help solve a case. So if you're someone who's interested in true crime, specifically unsolved cases, and you would like to hear my opinion on those investigations, please consider subscribing, whether you're watching on YouTube or listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use. It would be greatly appreciated. Okay, Jody Huizentrout. This is an interesting case, and some of you may have heard of it before. If you haven't, that's what this is all about. This case is full of twists and turns, and I'll tell you right from the jump that there is a particular person who many in the community who have looked into this case believe could be responsible for her disappearance. I'm going to tell you right now, I don't necessarily agree with them, and I will weigh in throughout the episode to let you know why. But there have been some developments in this case. There's hope in this one, even though it's 29 years old, and we're going to talk about that as well. So without wasting any more time, let's dive into this week's case. Jody Sue Huizentrout was born on June 5th, 1968, to her parents Maurice and Imogene in Long Prairie, Minnesota. She grew up there, and according to her sister Joanne, Jody, quote, had the most beautiful personality, and when she walked into her room, she really did light it up. After high school, Jody graduated from St. Cloud State University with a degree in TV broadcasting and speech communication. She went on to work for several TV stations before joining KIMT's morning show Daybreak in Mason City, Iowa in 1993. Jody's shift at the station started around 3 a.m., and she usually worked until around 12:30 or 1 p.m. That November, Jody moved into the Key Apartments, located at 550 North Kentucky Avenue in Mason City, just 5 minutes from the station. Shortly after moving in, Jody met a neighbor from her complex, John Van Nice, a district manager for a seed company who was about 20 years older than her. According to FindJody.com, a website run by journalists and retired officers, John seemed to take a strong interest in Jody. He even named his boat after her because, according to him, she had become such a big part of his life and, quote, made him feel so good. But Jody's friends and family had questions about John's intentions. Jody's friend Tammy noticed that Jody was spending a lot of time with John, so she decided to ask her about it, and when she did, Jody insisted that they were absolutely not involved. And even with that being the case, Jody's sister, Joanne, still believed that Jody knew John was interested in her. So this wasn't a mutual relationship. It was more platonic on Jody's side, but there was some acknowledgement that maybe Jody knew John was interested in being more than just friends. On June 10th, 1995, John hosted a surprise party for Jody's 27th birthday in Clear Lake, Minnesota. 2 weeks later, John, Jody, and a group of friends went on a water skiing trip to Iowa City. They returned home on June 25th. The next morning on June 26th, Jody anchored the news from 6 to 7 a.m. She then attended an annual golf tournament fundraiser at the Mason City Country Club. Jody loved to golf and was part of a team with a coworker and two local businessmen. Jody and the team played for a while that day, but rain eventually interrupted the game, so Jody went home to change into some dry clothes. At around 3:30 p.m., Jody returned to the country club where she mingled and attended the awards dinner. Now, during that dinner, two members of her golf team recalled Jody mentioning receiving, quote, nasty and naughty phone calls that were starting to annoy her. She also said that she was planning to change her number the following day. Jody left the club at around 8 p.m. and headed home. At 8:24 p.m., she called her friend Kelly, who lived in Mississippi, but Kelly wasn't home, so Jody spoke briefly with Kelly's husband. He later reported that Jody sounded, quote, cheerful and not worried during the entire conversation. Now, according to findjody.com, the following morning, Jody was scheduled to work at 3 a.m. to anchor the 6 a.m. news, and she didn't arrive on time, but that wasn't surprising because Jody was known to oversleep and would usually come in a little bit later. But by 4 a.m., she still hadn't shown up, so her producer Amy called her, and as expected, Jody had overslept and said she'd be right in. Amy later recalled that during this conversation, Jody sounded completely normal. So that call occurs, and Jody says she's going to be right in, but she never makes it to the station. And at 5 a.m., Amy tried calling her again, but this time, Jody didn't answer. Amy continued to prepare for the 6 a.m. newscast, and when Jody didn't show up at 6, Amy had to step in and anchor the hour-long broadcast. So that's really the foundation of what we're going to be talking about tonight, and I really wanted to be descriptive with times because we always talk about window of opportunity. Well, the duration in which this incident occurred, we're talking between 1 hour to 2 hours. You know, she was last heard from around 4 a.m., and she didn't show up at 5, and that's when Amy called again and she didn't pick up. So the assumption is that whatever happened to Jody happened between 4 a.m. and 5 a.m. So small window, we've had smaller, but what's really interesting is the distance in which this crime occurred, and that's also part of your window of opportunity. So what I have told you so far is that the distance from Jody's apartment to the station is only about 5 minutes, which is a small window. What I didn't tell you, and I'm about to right now, is that the distance from Jody's apartment to her vehicle, which is where it's believed that she was attacked, is only 12 feet. So now that window just got even smaller. And we're going to talk about all that. We're going to talk about persons of interest, and we're going to talk about some of the evidence that was found to indicate that she was attacked while walking to her vehicle. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall. With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Okay, we're back, and before break, I had given you some hints about what was to come, but before we can go down that path, we have to stay on the timeline. So, at 7 a.m., once the newscast had ended, Amy asked a coworker to call the police to request a welfare check on Jody. Officers arrived at Jody's apartment complex at approximately 7:15 a.m., and when they did, they found Jody's 1991 red Mazda Miata in the parking lot about 12 feet from her building. But they didn't just find Jody's car. Near her vehicle, they found evidence of a struggle. Jody's earrings, red high heels, hairspray, and a blow dryer were scattered across the lot. Scuff marks from her shoes were on the pavement, and they also found a bent car key on the ground nearby as well. Later, when the police spoke to Jody's loved ones, they learned that she always carried a purse and a briefcase filled with notebooks. Neither of those items were found at the scene. According to the Doe Network, officers went to check Jody's second floor apartment, and when they did, they didn't find any sign of a struggle inside, and Jody was nowhere to be found. While police were still at the apartment, John Van Nice arrived at the scene. He told officers that Jody had come by his place the night before. They watched a video from the surprise birthday party that he had thrown for her a few weeks prior, and they also talked about the recent water skiing trip, and then Jody had to go home. According to him, that was the last time he saw her. Police went on to question Jody's neighbors, and some even recalled hearing a scream at 4:30 a.m., but none of them thought to call 911. The police then expanded their canvas beyond the complex and eventually spoke to a man who lived up the street. He told them that he had seen a white van, possibly a mid-1980s Ford Econoline, in the parking lot of Jody's apartment complex around 4:30 a.m. that day. He said the van caught his attention because the lights were on, and he thought it might belong to a police officer because it was parked in a way that it blocked other cars from passing through. As you can imagine, after hearing this, the police began searching for the van immediately. The police also spoke to Jody's friends and family and learned that in the months leading up to her disappearance, she had mentioned a few times that she felt like someone was following her. And unfortunately, this is something that can happen to quote-unquote local celebrities, people who are on television in their community, because it attracts a different type of fan, right? When you have these big movie stars or national TV personalities, they almost seem unreachable. But when you have a local celebrity, there are certain fans who can cross boundaries and feel like there's a chance for them. They could be with this person because this is someone who's only minutes away from them at most times. So this can create an uncomfortable situation where you're on television in the community where you carry out your everyday personal life. So whether you're at the grocery store or at a restaurant, there are people within that vicinity who may like you, hate you, or maybe even have feelings for you, even though you don't know who they are. And listen, I can personally attest to this. When I came back from Big Brother, most people in the country now knew where I worked. So I had people in my community who were doing things to get me to intentionally stop them. I even had someone start showing up at my work, and they were going into our parking lot and leaving notes on my vehicle. So even for me as a police officer, it became an uncomfortable situation where I would go out to my vehicle late at night and not know what I was walking out to. And you know, I'm a grown man who has a gun, and yet I was still worried. So I can completely understand where Jody and many others who work in this profession come from every day. It's a blessing to be in that role, but it also does come with some burdens. Now, according to findjody.com, on the evening of October 8th, 1994, Jody called the Mason City Police from her apartment. She reported that she had been out walking with her friend when a small, newer white truck started following her. The driver was staring at her really hard, which made her uneasy. The responding officer took Jody's report and offered advice on how Jody could protect herself. Now, after this incident, Jody started taking self-defense classes. And to me, that just gives us a little insight into how much this really impacted Jody. It shook her up, period. For her to go to this length to start doing things to better protect herself, although we weren't there to witness this incident, it tells us that it was real. And frankly, it scared Jody. So obviously knowing that, it's that much more significant in my mind. However, she did confide in her sister Joanne, a few friends, and her self-defense instructor that she felt like someone might be following her on other occasions. Plus, if you remember at the top of the episode, I talked about that golf tournament and how she told some people the night before her disappearance that she had received some nasty and naughty phone calls. So there's definitely some validity to her fears and what she was concerned about. And if you go over to findjody.com, they also noted that Jody would have been, quote, easy to stalk. Her address and phone number were all listed in the public phone directory. Her work schedule was the same each day. And when she was on air, she frequently mentioned her plans for social and community events. So listen, if someone wants to find her, she's easily accessible. And this is kind of what I was alluding to earlier. She's even more accessible because, as they mentioned, her schedule's routine. They know when she's on air, they know when she's off air. And part of her job as part of a local news anchor is being part of the community. So she's mentioning where she's going to be and what time she's going to be there. So if someone has nefarious intentions, they can kind of track her whereabouts without her even knowing it. Now, based on everything the police knew so far, they concluded that Jody had most likely been abducted while she was unlocking her car door. And I don't think that's a stretch when you think about the distance from her apartment to her car. We talked about it, 12 feet. And then most importantly, there's a couple things there. You have the fact that when is she going to be at her most vulnerable point while she's putting the key in the lock, right? Now, on top of that, you have evidence to support it. The dragging of the heels, the heel being dragged through the dirt, and those photos are available where you can see, they'll probably pop up right here, where there's a photo of the heel being dragged along the dirt, which means more than likely it's from behind. And then you have the bent car key. So how would that key get bent? Think about how hard it would be to bend a key while stepping on it. No, more than likely it was in the door lock. So she puts the key in, and as she's holding it, she gets attacked and maybe she tenses up. She has the key still as she's being dragged away, and she bends it before it pops out of the door lock and lands on the ground. So it all lines up with the evidence that we have here. And I think this was an easy conclusion to come to. Plus, you also have the scream at 4:30. So that's also suggestive of someone who was caught off guard. So it all lines up, in my opinion. I'm not going to dispute that conclusion whatsoever. I think that's what happened. But even though I agree with them on that theory, there are still many questions that remain unanswered, and they're important ones. First off, was Jody abducted by someone she knew? And if not, had she been targeted by a stalker who had seen her on TV, or was she just the victim of a random attack? These are very important questions, because if you can answer that question, then you can narrow down your suspect pool. Within hours of police arriving at Jody's apartment, teams set out to search for her. The immediate area around the complex was combed, including a nearby park and a river. Unfortunately, heavy rain that day made the search conditions difficult. Soon, the search was expanded to cover areas farther from Jody's apartment, but no trace of her was ever found outside the evidence that I've already discussed. The police also conducted a thorough examination of Jody's car and her apartment. They were even able to lift a partial palm print from her Mazda, along with a single strand of hair. Now, as far as we can tell, neither of these items have been linked to anyone, and if it has, that information hasn't been made public. And I know when I say something like that, like, oh, it hasn't been made public, you're probably asking yourself the question, well, Derek, if they identified who this hair or this palm print belonged to, why wouldn't they go after this person? Well, there's a strong possibility that the palm print and the hair belongs to Jody. And if that's the case, why would you disclose that information publicly and put the suspect at ease? No. If they've already canceled this palm print and this hair out and they've, you know, traced it back to Jody, they're going to keep that information private, and they're never going to tell you publicly, because they want the suspect out there thinking, shit, is that palm print mine? They may be able to say, no, the hair is definitely not mine. But during that struggle, did they put their hand on the window and not realize it? They may not know, especially if they weren't wearing gloves. So we're not going to give suspects any insight into what we have or what we don't have, or where something that had potential came to a dead end. No, we're going to let them sit at home and wonder, are they going to be knocking down my door tomorrow? I don't know. Now, inside Jody's apartment, police found her journal, which she wrote in all the time. In it, she often mentioned wanting to find a job in a larger city with more opportunities. She also wrote about her social life, including outings with her friend, John Van Nice. According to the Arizona family, there was nothing negative written about John in the journal, and there was no indication of their relationship being anything more than a friendship. On June 27th, police questioned John further, focusing on his whereabouts at the time of Jody's disappearance. He stated that he had been at home that morning and that his friend LaDonna had called him at approximately 6 a.m. on the landline to confirm their morning walk. They ended up going on that walk together and everything was fine. Before ending his interview, John provided his palm prints and underwent a polygraph test, which, according to police, he passed. Police also interviewed LaDonna, who confirmed that she did in fact call John at 6 a.m. and he picked up. She recalled that during their walk, John didn't appear anxious. He even mentioned that Jody had stopped by his place the night before to watch the birthday video. On June 28th, the FBI and the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation came in to help with the search and investigation. By the following day, June 29th, investigators had interviewed more than 100 people, but no suspects had been identified. That same day, John spoke to KIMT, saying, quote, Jody was like a daughter to me. She was like my own child. He added that police had interviewed him twice, but hadn't indicated he was a suspect. Now, looking up some research on this case, there are people that believe by him speaking to the media and, quote, trying to get in front of it makes him look more guilty. Listen, I have to tell you, he went in voluntarily, gave two interviews. He knows that they're looking at him. Voluntarily gave his palm prints. Voluntarily took a polygraph test, which we know isn't perfect. There are people who are telling the truth and fail and can go to prison for a crime they didn't commit, and yet he still took it. And then on top of all that, even though he knows that everyone's looking at him, he goes on the news station that Jody works for and tells them right out, listen, she was like a daughter to me. She was like my own child. I've cooperated with police. They haven't indicated I'm a suspect. I'm an open book. So yeah, some people may think this is kind of like he's trying to like reverse psychology it, where he's trying to be the face of this tragedy, and yet he's the person responsible. And I have to acknowledge that's possible. Of course it is. Anything's possible. But from where I'm sitting, I think him doing all this extra stuff where he could have lawyered up and said, you know what? I know where this is going. I'm not saying anything else. I actually think it's in his favor. I think it actually makes him look better. However, this is definitely one of those things where I think the audience is going to be divided. So pause the video for a second. Let me know what you think about it. And not only for this case, but just cases in general. When you have someone who is a person of interest at this point, do you think it sways you one way or the other if they decide to start speaking to the media? Because I've heard people say too, oh, they won't speak to anyone. Clearly they're guilty. So you're kind of damned if you do and damned if you don't. How do you feel about it? Going on camera after this incident when you know that you're a person of interest, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Or is it not necessarily the decision to go on, but more about how you look and what you say when you do? Answer below. Let me know what you think. We still got more to talk about when it comes to John. We're also going to talk about a secret man that nobody knew about, including Jody's family. We're going to take our last break. We'll be right back.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall. With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
All right, we're back from break and we're going to continue on in the timeline. So on July 1st, Mason City Police held a press conference to announce that they were searching for that mid-1980s white Ford Econoline van that the witness had seen in Jody's parking lot the morning she disappeared. However, as far as I can tell, that van has never been located. A few days later, the police called off the physical search for Jody, though the investigation continued. And by the end of the month, they had interviewed more than 800 people, but according to police, there were, quote, no solid suspects. In mid-August, the Des Moines Register reported that police in the community were accusing John Van Nice of being responsible for Jody's disappearance. John told the Register that the police had, quote, worked him over pretty good and administered a lie detector test, which he claimed he passed with, quote, flying colors. Still, many doubted his innocence. In his interview with the Register, John was adamant that he was innocent. He added, quote, I have been crucified by this community. I have been crucified by the media. And I have to tell you, when I was doing the research and looking up some of the videos on Jody's disappearance, there's a couple media stories out there where basically the entire story is about John Van Nice and who he is and what he was involved in and his relationship with Jody. And so they don't come right out and say, yeah, we think he's the guy, but it talks little about her disappearance and then all about John Van Nice. So you can kind of deduce where they're going with it. So I have to agree with John here. There's something about him, something that was said, something that I never found, where people are set on him being the guy. What that is, I don't know. If you're from that community and there's something that I missed, please enlighten me. But from what I've seen, it's pretty circumstantial, and he has a decent alibi. I wouldn't say a completely exculpatory alibi. He still could have been involved and went on his walk with LaDonna. But it'd be hard. It'd be hard. And I think he would potentially display some type of behavior that LaDonna would have picked up on, and yet nothing. So as far as his comment about the community and the media coming after him, I don't look at it as hyperbole with the intent of trying to gain some type of sympathy. I think he genuinely felt that way, and justifiably so from what I can see. Despite all the community and the media suspicions, John was never arrested, and 6 months after Jody's disappearance, there were still no solid suspects. And according to the Globe Gazette, years passed with no major updates. Then in 2001, Jody's family requested that a judge declare her dead. The judge appointed an independent private investigator to review the case on the family's behalf. The PI went through Mason City Police Department records and consulted with the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation and the FBI agents that worked the case. And after finishing his investigation, the PI told the judge, quote, "There just isn't any evidence that Jody voluntarily left her apartment or staged the scene of her disappearance. There is evidence that she was involuntarily removed from her apartment complex." He added, quote, "There is no evidence that Jody is currently alive. Presumably, she met an untimely, early, and involuntary demise." After hearing all this information, the judge declared Jody deceased. Afterward, Jody's sister Joanne told the Gazette that this step was necessary to settle estate matters. She added that the family would keep searching for the truth of what happened to Jody. The investigation continued, and in 2004, police searched the basement of the home previously occupied by John Van Nuys. Police stated that the house had been searched before, and this was simply a recheck to make sure nothing had been overlooked. And as far as what we know from the outside looking in, the search didn't turn up anything new. Then, in 2010, the police announced that they hadn't ruled out any motives. However, they didn't believe that Jody's abduction was related to stalking. Now, they noted that there was no evidence of a stalker, no gifts, no cards, and no phone calls. But I want to push back on that a little bit, because we do know of a couple phone calls, and we got that information directly from Jody. According to her, they were nasty and naughty. And my question to law enforcement would be, have we figured out who made those calls? Because more than likely, if I'm reading between the lines, it doesn't sound like she knew the person who was making these phone calls. Maybe she did. Or they could have just been that random stalker who was calling her repeatedly because her number was publicly available. And that would be a reason for her to say, "I'm going to change my number tomorrow." You could take that both ways. It could also have been someone she knew. But even if it was someone she knew, you can still be a stalker even though you know the person personally. So I don't know how they got there. To me, this seems a little unnecessary to put this information out there. I don't know why they're doing it, but I've told you guys before, different departments, different leadership, they have all the information. I don't. Maybe it's a strategy. Maybe it's a tactic to put someone at ease. I don't know. I don't get it, and I don't necessarily agree with it. I think a stalker or someone who fancied Jody is still very much at play here. However, that wasn't the only thing that law enforcement had to say that day, because they also identified John, who was now living in Arizona, as a person of interest for the first time. Now, up until then, the media had referred to him as the friend of Jody's who had been questioned by police, and that was it. But now, officially, he was a person of interest. After that surprising announcement, there were a few major updates in the case until March 2, 2017, when a federal grand jury was convened. Now, during this grand jury hearing, John was subpoenaed to testify in order to provide fingerprints, palm prints, and a DNA sample. But even with this new evidence gathering, no indictments were issued against anyone, including John. So let me break this down for you. No doubt in my mind, you can convene an investigative grand jury where members of the community, peers of Jody, come together, hear all the evidence. They also have subpoena power, and they can bring people in, they can question them, and then they can decide whether or not to indict certain individuals. There's no doubt in my mind that this grand jury hearing was intended for John Van Nuys. Law enforcement, at this point, at least, they thought he was the guy, and they felt like they were close to getting there, and maybe with the help of the grand jury, they could get over that hump and indict him and go to trial with this case. What they have on him, I've said it multiple times in this episode, I don't know. The only thing I could say is maybe there's something that hasn't been released publicly that ties him to this. But if that were the case, why wouldn't they just charge him? So I think it's a hunch at this point. I think it's just a totality of circumstances of information they have, maybe something that doesn't line up with what he said. But this is what I've asked for in other cases, an investigative grand jury to get us over a period where prosecutors are on the fence about charging someone. Sometime this can swing the pendulum. So reading between the lines here, let me interpret this one for you. This was for John. And even with all the new information they got, they still couldn't get the jury to indict him. So now that they've gone this route, which I don't necessarily have a problem with, it's been a lot of years and they finally decided to take their shot. But by doing this, unless they get a confession from him, there's really no chance at charging him down the road. They would need something substantial. They took their shot. They missed. You have to live with it. And I just hope that Jody's family was consulted on this matter, because you have to know going into it that it's a big risk with a potential big reward, but there's also downsides to it. And if Jody's family believes that John is the guy, the probability of him being held responsible for this crime, in my professional opinion, is slim to none at this point. Law enforcement officers working this case, they didn't agree with me, because just 2 weeks after this grand jury hearing, Mason City Police obtained search warrants to place GPS tracking devices on two of John's vehicles, which, by the way, he did not own at the time when Jody disappeared. Now, at this point, especially with everything I've said about John to kind of counter what law enforcement has been doing, even though I'm no defender of John, I'm just trying to remain impartial. This is the point in the story where I would go get the warrant. I would want to know what narrative law enforcement was going off of, because as a narcotics officer, when I would get search warrants, you have to articulate a good amount in there for a judge to sign off on it. So we would be able to get some insight into what they have on John. Unfortunately, with this search warrant, it was sealed. So it's unclear what they actually went off of. But what we do know is that police later stated the GPS tracking didn't lead to anything helpful. So again, another swing and miss, but I do give law enforcement an A for effort. Although I do have to acknowledge they could be wasting precious time and resources, because the actual person responsible could still be out there. So that was in 2017. Let's fast forward to 2019, because John spoke to the media for the first time in years after Steve Ridge, a private investigator working on Jody's case, encouraged him to come forward. And John told reporters that he emphatically and repeatedly denied any involvement in Jody's disappearance. He described living in a suspended hell since she went missing, and said he even volunteered to undergo hypnosis to assist police in the search for her. So here's another example of John being cooperative, and I'll admit it could be a facade, but at this point, why would he try to convince anybody that he's innocent when he already knows everyone thinks he's guilty? And there may be investigators who worked on this case watching this episode right now going, oh, you're an idiot, Derek. But that must be because you guys have something that you haven't shared with us, which you're not entitled to do, but you know, it has been 29 years, so maybe give us a little bit more if there's something here that's substantial that indicates with a high degree of certainty that John's the guy. Maybe put that out there. You've done everything else at this point. But based on what I'm seeing, based on what I'm hearing, it seems like maybe a little bit of a case of tunnel vision. And if we're going to discuss information that wasn't released to the public by law enforcement, we're going to talk about one of those things right now, because a few years later in 2023, investigator Steve Ridge spoke to the U.S. Sun, revealing previously unreleased information that police were already aware of. Through his investigation, Steve discovered that Jody had a, quote, very secret relationship with a man that she had met just 10 days before she disappeared. Now, Steve said that he knew the man's name, but police had asked him not to disclose it. So this man, who was from out of state, had been staying at a home in Clear Lake when he met Jody at a bar. Their relationship intensified quickly, and they saw each other nearly every day for a week. According to Steve, Jody hadn't told her closest friends or family about the man because she was aware that the relationship might, quote, infuriate other suitors. Steve went on to explain that, quote, Jody had strong admirers. What that means, your guess is as good as mine. I take it as some potential stalkers or maybe some friends of hers that could potentially want more with her, and she was aware of it. I know some people from reading different articles took this as potentially being a shot at John. I don't know. It seemed like at points Steve was trying to help him out, or maybe by Steve telling John to come forward and tell his story, he was actually trying to bait him. It's interesting. There's a lot that can be unpacked here. It's also important to mention that Steve said he doesn't believe the secret man was involved in Jody's disappearance and that the police had already cleared him as a suspect. Steve did go on to say, though, quote, I believe without a doubt that this relationship was clearly a factor in what happened because this was not a random act of violence. This clearly was someone she knew and had interacted with who was very aware of all her relationships or people that she saw. What do you take from this? I'm taking this is a friend of hers. This is someone who cared for her, possibly wanted more with her. And maybe they found out that she was seeing someone behind their back, air quotes, right? Took that as disrespect and acted irrationally immediately upon finding out. And based on what we know so far, that pool of people is very limited, and maybe why law enforcement believes John's the guy. Is it possible that John wanted more, thought he was the only man in Jody's life, found out about this secret man, and that's the motive? Is this something that law enforcement has already deduced? These are questions that they have not answered. This case has a lot of twists and turns, a lot of ups and downs, and this could be a situation where, by proxy, Steve is relaying a narrative that is believed by law enforcement. And so this could give us some insight into why they think John is involved. But I would say, based on the ambiguity of the statement, depending on what you personally believe, you could interpret this statement multiple ways. So I'm not putting too much stock into it because it doesn't tell us a lot. And it's also just a theory by another investigator, just like I'm giving theories. But my man Steve wasn't done yet, because he also revealed that Jody's red Mazda, you know, the one we've mentioned multiple times, wasn't entirely owned by her. In fact, a few weeks before her disappearance, someone had purchased it for her as a partial gift, telling the salesman that they would cover part of the cost while she would pay the rest. Didn't see that one coming, but again, now you have another person of interest and or suspect. Steve suggested that this generous gift demonstrated the intensity of someone's admiration for Jody and the jealousy they would have if they learned about her and another man. And I gotta agree with him. That could be a motive. But we also know that John didn't purchase that Mazda. So whoever this person is, that's someone who should be looked at intensely, just as much as John has been looked into over the years. So lastly, let's fast forward to early November 2024, literally just a few weeks ago, when we got another major update in Jody's case. WSAW reported that investigators from Mason City had searched an area in Winsted, Minnesota, after receiving a new lead. Now, what came of that? We don't really know as of this recording. If there's an update, I will absolutely let you guys know, but I can tell you just based on what I've seen from the media, there's been no word on anything that was found, but Mason City Police stated they will continue to receive, evaluate, and follow up on any information related to Jody's disappearance. And they also encouraged anyone with information to contact MCPD or the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation. Sadly, that is the most recent update we have in Jody's case. No suspects have been identified, and Jody remains missing to this day, leaving her family desperate for answers.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Okay, let's dive into this perspective and kind of elaborate on some of the things I already said and recap some of the other information we learned about. First off, the attack, window of opportunity. I think most people will agree that Jody was attacked while unlocking her car. All the evidence supports it. From that point, that's where it starts to get a little hazy, because to me, there's multiple people who could be responsible for her disappearance and or death. And let's start with John. I've talked a lot about him. I've mentioned a lot of reasons why I don't think he's the guy. And just to elaborate on that even a little bit further, let's think about John and his relationship with Jody. He has multiple opportunities where he can get her inside her own apartment or inside his apartment, where he can hurt her, bind her, or even kill her with the safety of those walls around him. Why would he take the chance at attacking her in the early morning hours when someone who might know him because he lives there, see him and be able to identify him later? It would just seem like an erratic move, especially when you consider the fact that just the night before, he had the opportunity. She was in his apartment late that evening. So whatever he would have known about her, if there was another man and he became emotional or upset over that, that night when he saw her while they were watching that video, he would have already had that information. There was nothing that happened between them going to bed and 3-4 o'clock in the morning where he would have gotten up early to attack her. I'm just not seeing it. And then you add in there LaDonna, who calls him a couple hours later. He seems fine. He goes on the walk. Nothing seems off. No injuries or defensive, injuries on him from Jody if he had attacked her. Nothing at all. So either this was just a very lucky person or he's not the guy. So we've talked about John at length. I think we've covered him. Now let's turn our attention to some of the other people. We have the subject who purchased the vehicle. Has he been vetted? Has he been talked to? I'm assuming so, but if not, that obviously needs to happen. We also have Secret Man. Now, according to Steve Ridge, he's been vetted and he's not a suspect. I have to take him at his word. It seems like he's conducting a pretty thorough investigation and maybe even working with law enforcement off record, which does happen. Not often, but it does happen. But I want to talk about what I feel is the most likely suspect. And this is someone that I've hit on earlier in the episode, but haven't really come back to. Jody was an attractive young woman who was on TV all the time in this community. She could have had many secret admirers who wanted something more with her. And it's possible that one of those secret admirers, someone she didn't know personally, saw her maybe coming out of John's apartment, or maybe saw her with the secret man, maybe saw both and just was infuriated by that. And because this person knew her schedule, they decided to wait outside, potentially in a white van, and waited for her to come out. And when she did, she walked up to her car. The van was close. They were able to attack her from behind, place her in the van, and flee the area. Now, I know that sounds pretty straightforward and simple, but that's really, in my opinion, what we could be looking at here. Couple that with the fact that she had received those phone calls. I'm hoping that law enforcement looked into the phone records, and if they did, were they able to trace where they came from? That would be critical to this case, I think. Was it someone that she knew and that she just didn't know it was them? Or was it a random number that came back to someone else who has never had contact with her? That's the type of stuff that needs to be vetted thoroughly, and I'm hoping, even though this happened in 1995, they were able to do so. And that's really where I stand on this one. If you made me choose, I don't think John's good for it based on what's been made public. If there's something else that comes out that implicates him, I'll be the first to admit it. But I'm just not seeing it as of right now. And with these other persons of interest, we'll call them that for now, if they have their names, I'm assuming that they've been vetted thoroughly as well, which is why law enforcement decided to convene this grand jury essentially against John, even after knowing that information, which would only leave the scenario that I point out, which is that this person who committed this crime is still unknown to police. And this is going to be a very difficult crime to solve, because if this person has no connections to Jody, unless they come out or they slip up and say something, how do you tie them to it? If there's no DNA, if that long strand of hair and that palm print doesn't have anything that comes back to the offender and belongs to Jody, you're in a really difficult situation as an investigative unit. Like, where do you go from there? There would have to be something DNA-wise that would connect back to the offender at the crime scene. And through CODIS, there would be a potential hit to either the offender or a family member of theirs. Without that, this case is going to be very difficult to solve. However, on a positive note, it does seem like there's still a lot of life left in this case. As I mentioned, just a couple weeks before this recording, they're still following up on leads. And I ask myself, what was said and who was it said by to have them go out to this area and physically search it? It had to be something that they felt was at least somewhat credible. So I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that maybe they're not just showing all their cards right now and something was found at that scene and they're now taking the time to investigate it. And maybe shortly from the point of this recording, I'll have an update and we may have an arrest. So just to recap, Jody Huizentrout was last heard from in the early hours of June 27th, 1995. At around 4 a.m., her producer called to wake her up and she said she had overslept and that she would be on her way to the station. However, she never arrived. By 7:15 a.m., police had been called to her apartment complex at 550 North Kentucky Avenue in Mason City, where they found signs of a struggle near her red Mazda Miata. Her belongings were scattered in the parking lot, but Jody was nowhere to be found. When police canvassed the area, they learned that a white van, possibly a mid-1980s Ford Econoline, was seen in the parking lot at around 4:30 a.m. It has never been located. Jody is a white woman with brown eyes and blonde hair, standing approximately 5'3" tall, and at the time of her disappearance, she weighed between 110 and 120 pounds. Anyone with information on Jody's case can reach out to the Mason City Police Department at 641-421-3636. Information can also be provided to the Iowa Department of Criminal Investigations at 515-725-6010. But as always, my last words go out to Jody's family, specifically Joanne, who I've mentioned throughout this episode. As always, we're thinking about you, and I know it must have been a difficult thing to have your sister declared deceased because of legal matters, but it doesn't change the fact that as we sit here right now, we don't have anything definitive that says she's not out there somewhere. I'm a realist. It's not likely, but it's not impossible. So we're going to keep holding out hope. And at minimum, if something did happen to Jody, we all want for you and your family to get that justice. And we want the person who's responsible to be held accountable. And we're now along for the ride with you. We're going to be right here with you every step of the way. And I implore everyone who's listening or watching this episode to go over to findjody.com and research it for yourself and stay up with the story. And if there is a break in this case, I'll be the first to let you guys know. As always, that's going to do it for me. Everyone stay safe out there, and I'll see you soon.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall.
No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine.
Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.